Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile and smart speaker. This is the James Gray Show with the Lords Taverners.
You're listening to a podcast edition of The James Gray Show. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1:30 p.m. on Love Sport Radio, on DAB Digital, online or on your Alexa smart speaker. And if you're listening to the podcast, do leave us a rating and a review on iTunes, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Love Sport.
You're listening to The James Gray Show on Love Sport Radio. I'm here until 3:30 p.m. and I might just keep Three Lions on a loop in the background, frankly, because it was such a brilliant performance. Is football really coming home? Are we getting carried away again? Is it last summer? You know what? I said this last summer as well. And now that it's hot, in the words of Don Betts, the simple weatherman on Love Sport, it's hot. That's all you need for a weather forecast. He's right. And why not get carried away about English football? I think we're allowed to, because the women have really captured the imagination. In fairness, I thought last night was by far and away their best performance. They've not actually been perfect in the run-up to the quarterfinals. You know, they gritted their way through the early stages in the group against Scotland, against Argentina. Against Japan, there were moments, but even then, there were also moments where they slipped a little bit. And I think there are plenty of reasons, that, or at least there were plenty of reasons, to be apprehensive ahead of last night. Of course, we had both centre-halves, Steph Houghton and Millie Bright, passed late fitness tests. Lucy Bronze, by the way, at right-back, she'd been ill with a cold all week. So she wasn't as ill as Millie Bright, but she was far from 100%. So there are a lot of reasons we might have said before this game, and I pointed it out on yesterday's show, actually, that, you know, that there are things that could go wrong here, and frankly already have. And yet, Millie Bright stood up and was counted. Lucy Bronze won the Player of the Match award. She had that stunning strike to seal the win, and it books her place in Lyon for the semi-final, back home for her, remember. She moved there from Man City 2 years ago and has been part of the best side in Europe by some stretch in women's football. And of course, she's going to have Nikita Paris ahead of her next season. How good was she last night, at least in open play? Get her off pens. Nikita Paris now missed her last two penalties in the World Cup. Not been great. So maybe someone else. Maybe, I mean, Ellen White can't miss, or other than when she missed. It's not a dummy. Before anyone tells me it was a dummy, for the first goal, Ellen White missed it. But it's fine, because Jill Scott, actually, when you look at it, it looked like she scuffed it, but actually she readjusted her feet brilliantly. It was a fine finish. And Ellen White, just to mention her, she is so good up front in doing the hard yards. Sure, she fluffed her lines for that, but I love the way she plays. I really enjoy watching her work hard up front. She gets goals as well. She's in the conversation for the Golden Boot now. And she makes so many chances. She works so hard for the team. And actually, across the pitch, there are not many players who you couldn't give the tag of hard working. Because much as England did at times give the ball away or find themselves out of position, their cover was phenomenal. I've never seen a team at that level, you know, put blood, sweat and tears out there to such an extent, trying to cover each other. You know, when Lucy Bronze got forward, and it's one of her best qualities, by the way, she gets forward, she creates two-on-ones, sometimes with Nikita Paris, sometimes with Tony Duggan, and she's also excellent at selecting when to pass and when to dribble. You know, if the defender comes to her, she passes. If the defender doesn't come, she dribbles. And it must be a nightmare for a left-back dealing with Lucy Bronze and whichever winger, is ahead of her. So, frankly, why shouldn't we start getting excited about this England team? Sure, they've got France or the USA in the semis, and that's going to be tough, but I think we should get excited. The one probably group of people who shouldn't get excited are the team themselves. England's Beth Mead, for example, saying that the Lionesses can't afford to start dreaming about the final quite yet.
It's quite surreal. I mean, it gives me goosebumps thinking about it, but I guess it's hard to think past that right now. You know, we've got to prep for the next game, whoever we get tonight, you know. And then, yeah, I mean, yeah, 90 minutes away from a final is pretty nice. But, yeah, we've got semi-finals playing first and we've got to concentrate on that one.
What I love about that, by the way, as someone who's covered these events and done and been in these mix zones, is you can hear that Beth Mead is one of about 8 different England players talking to the media. And I know it's easy to do it the morning after a win, but this group of players are so eager to be in the limelight, and not in an attention-seeking way, but in a way that says, you know, we want to be part of this. We want to be part of this global wave of women's football. And that's kind of what's so inspirational about them. You know, away from the footballing side of things, and they have been excellent from a football perspective, especially last night. Probably Neville called it, I think, the best performance under him. Away from that, they've also been just special people, I think. I think when you look at what they've done and the way they've carried themselves, just as the men did last summer, the public have really got involved with it. They've really got hold of it and gone, yeah, this is a team we can get behind. And I think the fans have absolutely loved that. You know, we've had people, you know, the great thing about it being in France, of course, is it's easy enough to nip over. We saw that with the Euros, to nip over for a game. Lava, of course, extremely accessible. You could have gone over and back in a day, I fancy. Didn't even need to stay the night last night, although I think probably after that performance, you probably would like to. And there's been so many people doing that. Let's hear from a few of them who've headed over to France. They, of course, think it's coming home, and we all know what happened last time we said that about an England team in a World Cup.
Finally, I can breathe. Can't wait for Tuesday.
We never looked scared. There was always creativity there.
You can see the excitement for everyone in the crowd. David Beckham. It's great. Quality. Like, Norway are a great team. So that's a great result. So France, USA, whatever, it's coming home.
Excitement. I'll give them that. It's fine. Norway are a great team, she says. I'm going to take issue with that because I think it's important. You know, we can't just sit here and cheerlead the women. Yeah, they played brilliantly and I'm happy to be excited about that. But if you want to look for some negatives, they are there. So, for example, that Norwegian team, about half their starting lineup are part-timers. So, you know, you're not dealing with a completely professional side here. Obviously, they're without their best player as well. Ada Hegerberg, not at the tournament. The Ballon d'Or winner, not at the tournament as a protest against the treatment, initially over a pay dispute, actually, but now a sort of wider point about the treatment of women's football in Norway. And also, you know, much as Norway are not the best side in the world, England also did give them chances. Second half especially, Demi Stokes might have conceded a penalty. She, you remember, was the only change. Karen Bardsley made a couple of excellent second half stops. And there were sustained periods in the second half especially, and not the first time we've seen this, where England struggled to stick to their high passing standards. Now, it's 44 degrees in France at the moment. It's hot. The tournament is compact. England are only going to have, I think, 4 days to recover between their quarterfinal and their semi-final on Tuesday next week. So tiredness is going to set in. And I know Phil Neville's tried to rotate. He probably won't be able to make only one change to his team for the semi-final. But I think also, like a tennis player, your tennis players accept that sometimes their level drops and there's not a huge amount they can do about that. I think this England team need to find a way to not play as well, if that makes sense. A recognition that, oh, okay, we're in a five-minute spell where everyone's legs seem to be simultaneously a bit heavy, our parting's gone off a little bit, let's go to plan B, just for a bit. Not let's go long for the last 20 minutes, but what is our plan B when things aren't quite going right? And it's a very pragmatic approach, and you can't let it get out of hand, but it is a practical one, and one that works. I think you have to look at it and go, fine, 5 minutes, bit tricky, let's dig ourselves out of that. And that comes from Phil Neville in the end. He's got to be smart enough as a coach to recognise that no team can play the perfect game of football. Even Pep Guardiola, the ultimate perfectionist, accepts that no team can play the perfect game of football. And look, England are never going to do that. I don't think we've seen the best of them yet. They stepped up last night and it was their best performance of the tournament. But Tony Duggan's done nothing. Tony Duggan's probably the best player in that team, and she's barely featured. I know she's not been fit, but she was pretty anonymous last night. But what if Tony Duggan starts playing well? What if Ellen White starts not being surprised every time she scores? Fran Kirby's not had a massive impact on this tournament either, and she's a massively talented player. So there are still improvements England can make, and I don't think Phil Neville will let them rest on their haunches. You know, listening to everything he said this week, he said, we're desperate for this. We want this. We've always wanted to be in the limelight. We don't feel pressure because we're not afraid of failing. And that's kind of what's brilliant about this Women's World Cup, I think, is that it is, you know, they did the campaign She Can, the She Believes Cup. That's kind of what this is about. I watched the France-Brazil game on Sunday with my sister, who is a teacher. She's a head of department in a school. and she's a secondary school, and she said, you know what, this is so important because girls just don't even have role models for people who play sport. And participation numbers in girls' sport are shockingly low. And the drop-off from, say, the age of 10 to the age of 16 is incredible. It's almost complete, to be perfectly honest. And I think what these girls need are people up there who they can say, oh, well, I'm not just going to watch Wayne Rooney or Lionel Messi or Cristiano Ronaldo. I'm going to watch Nikita Paris. I'm going to watch Fran Kirby, Steph Houghton. These players who can be genuine role models to these women and girls who want to go out and play football on a regular basis. And they're not playing bad football anymore. Sure, 15 years ago, when the game wasn't fully professional, it was pretty unwatchable. It was a pale imitation. But this World Cup, you watch any of the knockout games, and they've been high quality, proper professional games. Even Norway last night, half of whom aren't fully professional. It was a professional outfit. And England are the exact same. Even if they lose in the semi-finals, I hope that we don't go, oh, another set of overhyped players. We're not that good at football. I hope that actually, for once, they come home and we go, you've inspired a generation here. Because I think they have.
Love Sport.
There will be a feel-good factor around Manchester United later this afternoon, we expect as well, because Aaron Wan-Bissaka completed his medical yesterday. And we think, and I suspect, it'll be 2 o'clock when we finally get the news of Aaron Wan-Bissaka becoming a Manchester United player. Let's speak to Love Sport's Manchester United columnist, Tom Wade's on the line. Remember, you can read Tom every Friday afternoon on lovesportradio.com. Tom, how good a signing is Aaron Wan-Bissaka for Manchester United?
Good afternoon, James. It's a statement of intent from United. You know, it was pretty evident last season that we had a problem in the defence, and the new age football seems to be wing backs and tricky wingers, and we needed a solution. It seems like Ollie's identified Wan-Bissaka as that player.
And of course, he led the tackling stats, I think some of the interception stats as well in England, even in Europe, I think, last season. But you think he's more than just a defender?
Yeah, I mean, he's a complete player, isn't he? He's able to go forward, he can attack. I mean, I watched him at Old Trafford last season against Manchester United. And, he's not scared to take on players, which is what they needed. I mean, no disrespect to players like Antonio Valencia and Ashley Young. They weren't getting any younger. And as I said, the demand of football these days is you need that player that can, you know, be able to defend, but also take the ball forward and not be scared to look for the overlap. And Wan-Bissaka offers Manchester United that.
Because of my role at Love Sport Radio, I've had a sneak peek at your column this week, and I think you picked out a particular pre-season tour of Hong Kong that sort of started this graduation of Aaron Wan-Bissaka.
Yes, I mean, when the club was first linked with Wan-Bissaka, I thought I'd do my homework on him and just get a feel of what he could potentially offer the club. And it turns out we've got former Palace manager Frank Vorderfank, because from the age of 11, Wan-Bissaka was actually a winger slash sort of striker, I guess you could say. You know, every young lad wants to be that Cristiano Ronaldo, Leo Messi, don't they? You know, they want to go forward and be the attacker. But the ball came into Palace and he decided that, actually, I want to play a 3-4-3 formation. And actually changed Wan-Bissaka's position to that right-back position. And, I mean, the rest is history from there. He stuck through it with Roy Hodgson and he seems to have really excelled in that role.
It's obviously, assuming they get the deal over the line today, which we think they will, it's the second youngster that United will have signed this summer after Daniel James. Are you expecting them, if they do go out and spend a bit more money, which I think they have to, are you expecting to see more and more kids significantly younger than you or I coming in?
I would say so. I think I'd say if you're looking for players right now, you'd have to look no further than players like your Bruno Fernandes, who the club has been linked with. I mean, I wrote last week in my column that Paul Pogba needed help. I think if we could get somebody like Fernandes in, he's young, he's a very, very good, tidy midfielder. You know, he knows where the net is, he can pass, his passing ability is phenomenal, and he's obviously only 24. You know, I think that's the sort of player we need, and we need centre, let's be honest, we need centre-back. It's okay addressing right wing back, and we've obviously got Luke Shaw at left back, but that centre back, we've spent so much money on players at centre back that it's never worked out. I think now you might need to identify that perfect player and really slot him inside and maybe give a player like Axel Tuanzebe a chance, you know? I was tweeting out the other day that I think last season at Aston Villa, he was fantastic. He was really one of the main players that made them so difficult to break down. And let's be honest, he couldn't, no disrespect, but he couldn't do any worse than players like Phil Jones and Chris Smalling.
He's an easy target, Phil Jones, isn't he? Well, in a number of ways, actually, quite frankly. I also want to ask you, Tom, about, you will have seen these links made between Manchester United and Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. What do you make of that? It's come from Italy, as far as I can see, and there's a Tuttosport report that he's said yes to the idea of switching to United. What do you think of it?
I've got to be honest, James, I don't know. I mean, you could argue, look at the last time we signed a striker from Arsenal, Robin van Persie, pretty much won us the title. But, you know, it's also, you've always got to be optimistic about these things, and then you've always got to be a bit cautious, because, you know, you look at a player that goes from a big club to another club in the Premier League, Fernando Torres, perfect example. Absolutely killed it for Liverpool. Goes to Chelsea, big money move, and it just seemed to break down and fall apart. I mean, I've always said Aubameyang is Arsenal's best striker. He should be the main man of that team. I rate him very highly, but whether United break through with that one, I'm not sure. I mean, it's pretty evident Romelu Lukaku's days are pretty much over. So I'm open to the idea, but I think they need to be a bit cautious when approaching that.
Tom, thank you so much for coming on, as always. Tom Wade there, Love Sports Manchester United columnist. And remember, you can read Tom's column this afternoon, of course, on Aaron Wan-Bissaka and why Frank de Boer is the man to thank for his development.
Love Sports.
This is the James Gray Show on Love Sport. We're here until 3:30 p.m. And I wanted to talk about this Michael Vaughan, Johnny Bairstow scrap, but actually in the context of Eddie Boothroyd. Because in his column today, Matt Dickinson said, what if he admitted that he had screwed up? That was what he asked in the Times today. Just before I do that, sorry, because something absolutely remarkable is happening in the cricket. If you turn on your TV at the moment to watch the cricket, what you will see is 13 or 14 men lying belly down on the ground. I've seen this once before somewhere in India when a swarm of locusts or wasps, I think, had come over the ground, and that's exactly what's happened this afternoon. I mean, this is absolutely remarkable that Sri Lanka are batting. They're 194 for 8. They've only got 2 overs left of their innings, and wasps stopped play. I don't even know what to say about it. I can't believe what I'm seeing. Every single player, the umpires are now standing up. I just say, that's it, lads. They've gone, but maybe they've moved on. I mean, there are loads of them, to be fair. As a proper swarm of wasps, I wouldn't fancy it. Can we abandon the game? This is Sri Lanka finding another way not to lose a game. They've picked up points because of rain, and now they've gone, you know what? If we get off here, we might get a point. I'm glad to say that they have now resumed, and Chris Morris's medium pace is significantly less dangerous than the swarm of wasps that just swept over the ground, I would suggest. Where was I? I believe I was talking about Eddie Boothroyd, a man with a waspish sense of humour, I'm sure. Matt Dickinson's column in the Times today questioned if Boothroyd had admitted that he made a mistake, would that be better? Because remember that in the under-21s he failed to pick Foden in what was essentially a must-win game against Romania. We didn't see any of Reece Nelson very much at all. He didn't fancy picking Tammy Abraham up front, although he probably is the under-21's best striker. Look, he claimed tiredness, and perhaps there were other reasons, but tiredness was the one that he stuck to. And it kind of worries people when they see a manager come out and stick to a reason that they think is so clearly untrue. You know, Phil Foden's not played very much for Manchester City, and yet he sticks to the reason. And I think the reason that he does that is that he feels if he admits to having made a mistake, that's it. He will basically write his own obituary by saying, I got this wrong, and he'll get the sack. Because that's kind of what the media do. When you stand up and say, I got this wrong and I got this wrong, well, it's open season, isn't it? You're offering yourself up as a sacrifice to the papers, who are looking for someone to blame anyway. And a lot of them, I know Tony Cascarino, for example, has called for him to get sacked anyway, that the decision to give him a contract just before the World Cup, the European Championships, should say, was a mistake. But this is what happens when you don't have a relationship with the media. And when you start to, I think, build up things in your head about what the media are and what the media are going to do with you. Because AD Boothroyd probably could have sat in a press conference and said, yeah, I got it wrong because of this, this and this. If he thought that he had a decent relationship with the media, if he thought that doing that would make it easier for him. And by saying, look, these are the mistakes we made, and this is what we're going to do. And I think certain corners of the football covering media would have said, oh, great, AD Boothroyd treating football like you would any other business. He's looking at the mistakes he's made and he's going to rectify them for next time. Because football is such a small sample size that, yes, sometimes these mistakes can look much bigger than they actually are. And they do have pretty big ramifications for the tournament. But it's not lost England any money. They haven't, you know, been relegated. They're not going to have less revenue next year because they didn't get out of the group in the European under-21s. In fact, it doesn't make much of a difference. And I think it's great to keep him in post. And that's the problem. So you look at someone like Johnny Bairstow, for example. He says, oh, people were waiting for us to fail. They're not willing us on to win in many ways. They're waiting for you to get that loss so they can jump on your throat. It's a very typical English thing to do in every sport. I don't really buy that, I'm afraid. I don't think that's how we do it. You know, I've sat in press boxes, I've worked in the media, and yeah, when things go wrong, it is your obligation, it's what you have to do to say this went wrong and this is why. And you're always looking for someone to blame because that's what readers do. That's what listeners do. That's what viewers do. They want someone to blame. They want you to explain what went wrong. You can't just say, well, everyone just did a bit badly on the day, because that's not interesting and it doesn't give people a resolution. You wouldn't watch a film, or you wouldn't enjoy a film, say a murder mystery, where at the end the police went, well, we haven't really solved it, and we actually think everyone's a little bit guilty in this case, and we'll just have to think about that going forward. You wouldn't watch it. You wouldn't watch that film. And it's the exact same thing when it comes to sports reporting. You're looking for, in the same way that when they play well, and when Johnny Bairstow, if he does score 100, if he does walk out and get 100 against New Zealand or India and win the game, the back pages will be covered in his face, praising what he's done. And in the exact same way, when England lose, we'll look for someone to blame. Because it's not interesting if there isn't someone to blame. And that's what sport's about. It's entertainment. But then you see Michael Vaughan, and I very rarely agree with Michael Vaughan. He thinks Bairstow is wrong. And so in that sense, we do agree. He says, how wrong Johnny Bairstow can be. Never has England team had so much support, but it's you and your team that has disappointed Johnny. Win two games and you're in the semis. With this negative, pathetic mindset, I'm concerned, though. It's not the media's fault. You've lost three games. Yeah, I mean, again, he's hard to argue with because he's right. England have lost three games, and there isn't a lot that the media have had to do with it, frankly. But I also find that last little parting shot, you know, negative and pathetic attitude, that's not what this is. I don't think that's what Bairstow's doing. I actually think, and I've seen it before with Bairstow, he's a chippy guy. He's someone who thrives off thinking that no one believes in him. He came into the team and they said he couldn't play the short ball. Well, specifically, couldn't play Dale Steyn's short ball. And he couldn't. He came into the team and they made him wicketkeep a bit and they said he can't wicketkeep. And frankly, he couldn't. They came into the team and they said he's not a good enough batsman to make runs at the highest level in international cricket. And he couldn't. But all of those critics and those doubters, they made him so much more determined. You know, anyone who knows Bairstow knows he's one of the hardest working cricketers around. When we still had Alistair Cook, the bleep tests were a race between him and Cook because he's that fit. No one spends more time in the gym than him, and he's worked so hard on his wicketkeeping with Bruce French, the England wicketkeeping coach, in an effort to improve his wicketkeeping. He is a fantastically committed and driven individual. But with all of these people, all of these sports people, and it's the question I always try and ask, even if not directly, whenever I'm interviewing someone or meeting a sports person, I always think, why do you do that? Why do you get up at 5 a.m. to go to the gym? Why do you spend 3 hours after training catching balls? What drives you? And I think for Bairstow, it's the belief that people don't think he's as good as he is. It's that chip on his shoulder that really drives him. And I think this comment, you know, they're waiting for us to lose so they can jump on our throat. Everyone does it. I think what he's saying there is, the world's against me. Everyone's against me. And Bezos, look, he's not had a good World Cup. And there probably has been a lot of criticism. And he's probably seen a lot of social media where, yeah, it's usually the very vocal minority. But a spat with Michael Vaughan, it happens all the time. Stuart Broad's had one, and they kind of accept. I think Bairstow was played a clip of Vaughan saying that England could be heading for their world's worst cup. Their worst World Cup. And he said, as he said, he's been in true atrocious World Cups himself. We're still in. We're playing a great brand of cricket. It's just showbiz. They're paid to have an opinion. And I actually think Bairstow took that a bit more personally than he's pretending. He's pretending that he just said, oh, Vaughan, he's just a pundit. He doesn't really know anything about us, and we'll just carry on and not listen to him. I think Bairstow will play that clip on repeat. I think he'll be in the gym with his weird wireless headphones in. Sorry, that's a personal bugbear. I just don't understand wireless headphones. I think they look really weird. Yeah, I know. I've just been shown a pair by producer Mike, who is weird. I mean, look, this is the bloke who... you should see the clobber he turns up in. This is why he works in radio, not TV. Anyway, I got distracted by his terrible, terrible dress sense. Bairstow will be listening to all of those critics. He'll have Michael Vaughan on a loop in the gym, because that's what'll drive him. That's what'll push him through those innings. You know, when he's 10 off 13, he's thinking, oh, maybe I should just have a swing, and if I get out, I get out. It'll be Vaughan's voice in his head driving him forward and making sure that he performs his very best for his country. Because they actually, those types of people, so often they're the successful types. It would be great to think that every top sportsman is someone who had love and attention from every corner of their upbringing. Every coach, every parent, every uncle, every grandparent all went, oh, you're doing really well, keep going. But it's not true. Because actually, so many of the top sportsmen are driven by their doubters, driven by the naysayers and the haters, and Bairstow's one of them. So I say, let's load up on the hate, and Johnny will go out and get 100.
Love sport.
Let's ask Molly McElwain what England's chances will be in that last four. First of all, Molly, that performance last night, I heard Neville call it the best that he's had from his team under him. Is that a fair assessment?
Hi, James. Yeah, I mean, it's the best one we've definitely seen at this World Cup. I think everyone is in agreement about that. It was a performance that they really needed, I think, to sort of cement themselves as and really sort of live up to the label of them being real contenders here. They properly did that last night.
In terms of the next opponent, France or the USA tonight, who do you expect to win that game? It looks like two of the best sides in the world in the quarterfinals.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really big match. I think the favourites are definitely the USA. They've only been tested really in the last 16 against Spain, where they had a bit of a wobble, but they've looked like the strongest side coming into this tournament and throughout the tournament. But yeah, France is the biggest test they've had so far for sure, because they're as the host, and also with all of the Lyon talent they've got in their starting 11, you can't really discount them either.
Neville was saying on the pitch last night, he doesn't mind who they play. Really? Wouldn't they rather take on France?
I mean, yes and no, because you've got the USA, obviously, they're the team with all the silverware behind them and having proved themselves on the world stage before. And obviously, they've proved their scoring power at this tournament. But I mean, France is the host. I've been at, I think, three of France's games so far, and the atmosphere at those stadiums has been really impressive. And it's really been like 12th man for them. It's been a really big, I think, help to them and boosted them and helped them get through some really sticky situations. So, USA are the favourites, but I think France could pose a big test. Either team are going to be a big test for England, but at least their performance last night has given them the confidence going into it for sure.
A little bit of the walking wounded, or the walking ill, I should probably say, because I know Lucy Bronze has had a cold all week. Millie Bright's basically been on quarantine duty. Do you think you'll see much rotation from Phil Neville? Because they've only got, what, four clear days to recover for their semi-final?
I think... Neville's changed the team around a lot during the group stages, and last night really showed a strong side that I don't know if he'll want to deviate a lot from it. I think Tony Duggan still doesn't seem at her best, so maybe Beth Mead might start ahead of her. You never know, because she did well when she came on last night for about 40 minutes. So I think changes will be minimal, even though obviously that you've had all the virus talk in the camp. I think last night proved that most of the team are at full fitness, and you don't really want to mix it up when you've had such a convincing performance.
It seems there's a bit of a pattern to England's performances at this World Cup so far, in that even when they have ground out wins, that there's always seems to be a period where they go to pieces. The passing seems to slip. They concede a couple of chances. And Norway did have some really good chances last night. Does that concern you at all?
I mean, yeah, I think it has been a pattern throughout the tournament. But I'd say last night was they had the fewest mistakes they've had in the tournament. But yeah, that Millie Bright back pass to Karen Bardsley really, really, it would have had everyone sort of very nervous there on the bench, on the pitch, everyone watching, all the England fans watching. But I'd say their sort of 10-minute lapse in concentration was also due to Norway really just upping the pace and the intensity, because obviously they had nothing to lose at that point. England had just gone 3-0 up. So, I mean, I'd say it's still a little worrying. That's the one thing that Neville will really need to try and perfect, I guess, and try and address going into the next few days.
What would you say has been the impact of this World Cup back home? I know you've been out in France covering it, but, you know, record television figures. But it does necessarily feel, you know, if I go back 4 years, I'm sure there were record television figures then as well. Is this a false dawn, or is this a watershed moment for women's football in this country?
Well, like you said, I've been in France the whole time, so I haven't actually been able to see myself the impact it's having, I guess, in the UK as much. But those having record-breaking television figures, like you said, it might have happened in 2015, but for it to continue happening just shows that there's still that momentum behind the women's game. And I think having a tournament in France has made it so much easier for UK fans to engage in with it, just because of timings and all that kind of thing. It's been like the perfect storm. I really do think it's having a huge impact. I mean, seeing the pictures like Glastonbury, where there were massive crowds watching the match last night, it's just an encouraging scene, and one that you can compare with the World Cup last year with Russia. So, yeah, I do think it's really pushing on to become a real watershed moment. And if England keep going, it can only get better, especially for football in the UK.
Just finally, you mentioned Tony Duggan there, and I agree with you, really. She did look a bit absent last night. She's not been anywhere near her best. Who's been your player of the tournament for England so far?
I mean, last night, Lucy Bronze made a huge statement. She stepped up in the way that top players need to in moments like these, in the big moments. I think she had a hand in all those goals, and her goal was just incredible. It had me jumping out of my seat. But I'd say she's been a standout for me. But then Jill Scott has also been just integral to England's team. She's been working so hard up defence and in attack. I mean, I think she's one of those players that sometimes can go under the radar despite all the work she does. But yeah, her goal last night really was a nice moment, I think, for everyone who's been following the team, because it really felt well deserved. So I'd say those two.
She's absolutely everywhere. You're right. I mean, Jill Scott appears to play about four different positions at the same time.
I know.
Quite remarkable. Well, Molly, what's your prediction for England? Where do you think, are they going to win this World Cup?
That's a tough one. I mean, I think it depends on how their opponent shows up in the semi-final. Because I'd back them to win in the final, but the semi-final is going to be tricky. I'm going to be at the USA-France game tonight, so I'll get back to you on that one after I see how it performs.
Brilliant. Molly, thank you so much for coming on, and we'll keep our fingers and toes crossed, of course, for the women out in France. Molly McElway there, women's football reporter for The Telegraph. She's off to USA-France tonight. That's quarter-final, of course, will decide who takes on England in Lyon on Tuesday. Both of those 8 o'clock kickoffs.
Love Sport.
And we're also celebrating Liverpool making their first signing of the summer, because they've picked up Sep van den Berg. I don't know the Dutch for who, but you'd be fair to say it. Let's ask James Rowe, Dutch football expert, exactly who this man is and how excited we Liverpool fans should be getting about him. James, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, James. How are you? Thanks for having me on again.
Getting on well, and delighted that Liverpool have picked up some of Europe's top talent. Or, I mean, I literally had heard very little about Sep van den Berg. What can you tell me?
Well, what I can tell you is he came through the youth setup at Pek Zwolle here in the Netherlands. And he was very highly thought of, even from a young age. And he went on to become the youngest ever debutant of Pek Zwolle in the Eredivisie at 16 years and 81 days. And he was recommended to the then manager, John van Schip. And he was recommended to van Schip by the current Dutch national team assistant, Dwight Lodewijkers, and about how much quality he has. And van Schip decided to let him train with the first team. And then you could see quite clearly his talent was coming through. He's a very good header of the ball, and he has great awareness. Under the previous Pek Zwolle manager, Jaap Stam, Sep van den Berg didn't really get much game time. Only, I think it was two appearances, and because Stam was choosing experience over youth. But he's definitely got a very bright future ahead of him.
In terms of the amount they've paid for him, it's only, what, £2 million or just under that, I think. It seems like nothing. Is there a sort of an expiring contract on the horizon or something?
No, I think it's just that the clubs, you know, they realise here in the Netherlands that you have young, exceptional talent that can go at a young age. I also think this club didn't want to stand in his way. I think they was aware that this is an opportunity for him. And he himself, upon his when he was presented as a player, you know, as a young man of only 17 years of age with a fair bit of first-team experience behind him, you know, it's a fantastic opportunity for him. And I think he's very excited to be joining, in his words, one of the best teams in Europe.
I assume he's not really going to be a member of the first-team squad at Liverpool, or actually, is that how good he is?
Depends. I mean, obviously, you know, obviously with his countryman Van Dijk, it could be someone who maybe takes him under his wing. But I think that you see now with young players, I think that they're looking for a little bit of certainty where they have game time. Because certainly lots of young players here in the Netherlands, James, it's about when they leave the Netherlands and go on to different countries, about getting regular game time. So I think with Van den Berg, I think it was something for him which was a chance that doesn't come by every so often. And so an opportunity he felt he had to grab with both hands. But it will be very interesting to see how it develops.
Love Sport.
Time to talk to Jonathan Johnson, because he is ESPN's French football reporter, and he knows everything about French football. And Nottingham Forest have just appointed Sabri Lamouchi as their new manager after Martin O'Neill left, of course. He was sacked. They say, Jonathan, I appreciate I'm throwing a curveball at you here, but what can you tell me about Sabri Lamouchi?
Hey there, thanks for having me on. I'll be honest with you, I'm not that convinced by Lamouchi from what I've seen. He had a very mixed experience with Ivory Coast at international level, and then came to Ligue 1 with Rennes and didn't fare that much better. And it's still early days in his coaching career, so I guess he shouldn't be sort of written off after that. But I'd say that there's room for improvement. So perhaps, in a way, dropping down a level to a second tier within Europe is perhaps the best thing for him. That said, you look at the recent record of coaches who've gone to Nottingham Forest, particularly someone like Philippe Montaigne, who later came back to France with Lens. It doesn't make particularly pretty reading. So I'd say that he faces a big task there, and definitely needs to improve on what we've seen from him in France so far.
Yeah, it seems like an odd signing, put it that way. I mean, it's great that they've got someone immediately, but I wasn't totally convinced by it. I also want to ask you, of course, because it's the name that's been on the lips of so many of our listeners, we have a lot of Tottenham fans listen to the station, Tanguy Ndombele. I kind of thought we'd be talking about him being a Tottenham player by now, but I now read that the Lyon president has said if we wait another 8 days, it'll be £72 million. What's going on here?
Yeah, well, you know, Levy has finally met his match in Olaf. You know, they're both very like-minded characters. You know, when both are involved in selling players, you know, they look for the absolute best possible deal for their clubs. You know, so it's no surprise, particularly since Ndombele has now said that he does want to leave this summer. So Olaf knows that he definitely wants out. You know, there's no sort of approaching deal for Nabil Fekir looking like it's going to materialise in the next week or so either. So it, you know, he's right to take his time and sort of drive up that demand for Ndombele. You know, I also think given the number of European clubs who have shown an interest in him in the past, it is possible that by delaying this, you know, Olaf potentially brings someone else back into the fold in that pursuit as well.
How good is Ndombele? Is he worth the 60, 70, God knows how much they hold out for?
I mean, is any player worth what clubs have to pay to buy them these days? It's you know, it's crazy some of the figures that we have to talk about on a regular basis. I'm a big fan of Ndombele. I rate him very highly. You know, I think in terms of central midfielders, you know, particularly with an eye towards the defensive side of things, you know, there are a few better in Europe. He's come a long way in a short space of time. He's now a senior France international when you consider that just a couple of years ago, he was in the French semi-professional third tier with Amiens. You know, that's a pretty impressive rise. I think he is a very well-rounded player. When you look at him, you know, I think you expect him to just be, you know, a very strong, very powerful player, very physical, you know, who's good in the tackle, good in the air, you know, but he's actually surprisingly technical as well. He can carry the ball well, you know, and he's no slouch either. You know, I think his build counted against him earlier in his career, you know, but he's now reaping the dividends. So it's, you know, it's not surprising to see him in huge demand this summer, and I think he's tailor-made for the Premier League.
Another man who once was that powerful midfielder you were talking about is Patrick Vieira, and we're seeing him being linked with the Newcastle United job. Now, I don't think any sane manager in the world should take that job at the moment, but apparently I'm the only one who thinks it. What's he been like as a manager at Nice so far? What's he achieved, and how would you characterise his sort of style?
I think it would be madness if Vieira does consider leaving Nice for Newcastle, particularly at this moment in time when you consider that he'd be following in the footsteps of someone like Rafa Benitez, you know, who's done a fantastic job at most of the clubs he's been with over the years, has achieved a lot of things in the game, did a very good job with Newcastle in very limited circumstances. So I'd say that Vieira will be better suited or better served staying with Nice for the moment. He's done quite well so far. Since his move from Major League Soccer, he got off to a bit of a slow start, but he's got Nice, you know, playing a vibrant style of football, or had them playing a vibrant style of football towards the end of the season. I mean, he's been locked in a couple of battles with a number of the egos at Nice since his arrival. Obviously, Mario Balotelli was one of those, who's now departed and has gone to Marseille and is probably on the move again this summer. And Alain Saint-Maximin as well is somebody that Nice look like they'll be getting rid of this summer. So with you know, obstacles like that out of the way, I think it makes it easier for Vieira to construct the kind of squad that that he wants to. He's had particular joy with Youssef Attal, who was very impressive towards the end of the Ligue 1 season. And if Nice can keep hold of him, they'll have done very well. And you know, I think that you know, this next season for Vieira is shaping up to be a very interesting one. To make a move to such a risky destination as Newcastle at this moment in time, you know, would be a big mistake, especially with Nice on the verge of being brought out as well.
Well, Jonathan, I can tell you that if he went to Newcastle, it wouldn't be any less interesting, but it might not be a good thing for him. Thank you so much for coming on, Jonathan Johnson there, France correspondent for ESPN FC, and John Le Gossip on Twitter. Make sure you give him a follow as well.
Love Sports.
Now, you might not have heard of CBD. You might have heard of it as cannabidiol, if I've pronounced that right, or cannabis plant extract. What you might not know is it's something that's regularly used by almost 500,000 people in the UK, and it's legal to buy over the counter. It's even used by sportsmen. I've got a couple of them on the line now who are regular users of it. Dom Day and George Cruz, the Saracens' second rows. I couldn't fit them both in one studio, frankly, so we've got them down the line. Dom, I want to start by asking, most people don't really know about CBD, so how did you come to try it, and how does it work as far as you know?
Yeah, so, you know, I was having a couple of sort of setbacks in early 2018, and I was looking for a way sort of to get myself back fit and more of a natural therapy, natural remedy, and I saw that CBD had been taken off the WADA banned list, so I was like, well, you know, I'll give this a go. As you do when you're injured, you sort of, you'll try anything you can really to get back on the pitch. I just saw great improvement with my symptoms, and that's pretty much how I got into it. And you know, we managed to turn it into 4-5 CBD and the business it is today.
Presumably, initially, you were maybe a little bit sceptical. You know, you're a sports person. I know you're very careful about everything you put into your bodies, and cannabis, obviously, you know, this is a cannabis product after all. But presumably, you were reassured this is an active ingredient, but it doesn't get you high. Is that right?
Yeah, you're exactly right. You know, there's two different aspects to sort of cannabis. There's your THC, which has a mind altering effects, and your CBD, which is what we use. So we've obviously brought out, as you say, we've got to be super careful about what we put in our bodies. It's obviously our jobs at stake here, so we've put a massive emphasis on the testing side of things and making sure that our product is the safest out there. And you know, we've gone to a company called BSCG, an American testing company, to make sure that it's tested for athletes and there's absolutely no cross contamination and no banned substances. And you know, we're the first product in the world to do that, so we're hugely excited about it.
And obviously, coming up at the XL in London in a couple of weeks is a big sort of trade weekend. How excited are you to go out and meet some other people within the CBD world, I suppose?
Yeah, so the Europe CBD Expo on the 12th and 13th, you know, we're going to be there, and you know, we're looking to sort of meet as many people that can get down there, and obviously get in contact with other people in the industry. And it's the first of its kind really in the UK, and we're just hugely excited to be a part of it because it's going to be such a big event, and you know, the people there are going to be sort of the leading minds and the leading businesses in the industry.
George, I wonder if I could ask you a couple of things as well.
Sure thing.
Dom obviously mentioned that he'd been through a lot of injuries in career. I think between the two of you, you've been under the knife 12 times. Look, rugby's a game of pain. I feel like it's a big part of it. Presumably before you came to CBD, were you also using, I've read articles about sportsmen using a lot of things like ibuprofen, you know, those non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. Presumably you're a bit sick of taking pills all the time.
No, it's something you have to get through and do to get yourself back, you know, back on the field. I think with CBD, although we can't make any medical claims, for me the highlight factor is that it's, you know, it's a natural product. You know, our 4-5 CBD is 100% natural. It's pesticide, herbicide free, vegan and vegetarian friendly. So for me, it kind of screams all like the good things of what we should be doing. You know, it's got a great safety profile as well. So it kind of struck me as something that I'd like to be taking, you know.
I'm sure you're regularly recommending it to your teammates. I'm sure you're a good salesman. But I also imagine when you first started using it, they were probably quite sceptical. And a lot of people around you, I imagine, went, well, hang on, this is cannabis, George. You're a professional rugby player. This isn't right.
Yeah. No, and rightfully so. Like, I think we embrace the critics or the people who question. I think you have to have standards. There has to be regulation. And I think there was a Times article just yesterday of how much CBD content is actually in, you know, provided CBD bottles by different companies. So, you know, there was a big study on that, and you know, there were mixed results. So we fully embrace these questions. I think we've gone, like Dom said, we've gone to massive lengths to ensure that we can prove the provenance of our product. I think like as rugby players and as athletes, I'd say we're quite simple people in terms of if you can prove that, you know, that you've done all the testing that needs to be done, then we're all up for trying to find the next, you know, the next thing to help out.
And in terms of your own physical shape now, do you feel that you're better, or at least just able to cope better? Is that the best way of putting it?
I feel, aside from my foot, which I've had a tidy up on, so I'm in a boot right now. I feel good. I'm looking forward to hopefully what comes in the next 3-4 months.
I also want to ask you, George, because of course we had the news recently, Warren Gatland's sort of re-signed on for the British and Irish Lions. Of course, that's a setup I'm sure that you're looking forward to in a couple of years. I know it's a long way off, but what does Warren bring to a camp like that? What kind of a coach is he? And were you surprised that he felt he had to do it again?
Well, I think if you've had the taste for that larger a coaching role, then it'd be hard to put it down. In terms of what he brings, he's a different coach to anyone I've been under before. He's quite good at pumping the players up. It's an unbelievable spot to be in, and fair play to him. He's done it, 3 times now, so we'll go for the 4th.
Lads, thank you so much for taking the time. Really interesting to hear about CBD. And if you do want to learn more about it, you can head down to the XL July 12th and 13th for the expo. And I'm sure Dom and George will be down there, and they'll be happy to answer all your questions as well.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to a podcast edition of The James Gray Show. Remember to leave us a rating and a review, but only nice ones. I don't take criticism well.